Here we go.
Chapter 6, The Synthesis of the Disciplines of Knowledge. In the last chapter, we have spoken of renunciation in its most general scope, even as we spoke of concentration and all its possibilities. What has been said applies therefore equally to the path of works and the path of devotion as to the path of knowledge. For on all three, concentration and renunciation are needed, though the way and spirit in which they are applied may vary. But we must now turn more particularly to the actual steps of the path of knowledge, on which the double force of concentration and renunciation must aid us to advance. Practically, this path is a reascent up the great ladder of being, down which the soul has descended into the material existence.
The central aim of knowledge is the recovery of the self, of our true self-existence. And this aim presupposes the admission that our present mode of being is not our true self-existence. No doubt, we have rejected the transient solutions which cut the knot of the riddle of the universe. We recognize it neither as a fiction of material appearance created by force, nor as an unreality set up by the mind, nor as a bundle of sensations, ideas, and results of idea and sensation with a great void or a great blissful zero behind it, to strive towards as our true truths of eternal non-existence. We accept the self as a reality and the universe as a reality of the self, a reality of its consciousness and not of mere material force and formation, but nonetheless, or rather all the more, for that reason, a reality. Still, though, the universe is a fact and not a fiction, a fact of the divine and universal and not a fiction of the individual self. Our state of existence here is a state of ignorance, not the true truths of our being. We conceive of ourselves falsely, we see ourselves as we are not, we live in a false relation with our environment, because we know neither the universe nor ourselves for what they really are, but with an imperfect view founded on a temporary fiction, which the soul and nature have established between themselves for the convenience of the evolving ego. And this falsity is the root of a general perversion, confusion, and suffering, which besiege at every step both our internal life and our relations with our environment. Our personal life and our communal life, our commerce with ourselves and our commerce with our fellows, are founded on a falsity and are therefore false in their recognized principles and methods. Also, through all this error, a growing truth continually seeks to express itself. Hence the supreme importance to man of knowledge, not what is called the practical knowledge of life, but of the profoundest knowledge of the self and nature, on which alone a true practice of life can be founded. And nature, here there is a footnote, Atmajnana and Tattvajnana.
The error proceeds from a false identification. Nature has created within her material unity separate seeming bodies which the soul manifested in material nature, which the soul manifested in material nature, unfolds, inhabits, possesses, uses. The soul, forgetting itself, experiences only this single knot in matter and says, I am this body. It thinks of itself as the body, suffers with the body, enjoys with the body, is born with the body, is dissolved with the body, or so at least it views its self-existence. Again, nature has created within her unity of universal life separate seeming currents of life, which form themselves into a whirl of vitality around and in each body, and the soul manifested in vital nature seizes on and is seized by that current, is imprisoned momentarily in that little whirling vortex of life. The soul, still forgetting itself, says, I am this life. It thinks of itself as the life, craves with its cravings or desires, wallows in its pleasures, bleeds with its wounds, rushes or stumbles with its movements. If it is still mainly governed by the body sense, it identifies its own existence with that of the world and thinks, when this world is dissipated by the dissolution of the body around which it has formed itself, then I shall be no more. If it has been able to sense the current of life which has formed the vortex, it thinks of itself as that current and says, I am this stream of life. I have entered upon the possession of this body. I shall leave it and enter upon the possession of other bodies. I am an immortal life revolving in a cycle of constant rebirth.
But again, nature has created within her mental unity, formed in the universal mind, separate seeming dynamos, as it were, of mentality, constant centers for the generation, distribution, and reabsorption of mental force and mental activities, stations, as it were, in a system of mental telegraphy, where messages are conceived, written, sent, received, deciphered. And these messages and these activities are of many kinds, sensational, emotional, perceptual, conceptual, intuitional, all of which the soul manifested in mental nature accepts, uses for its outlook on the world, and seems to itself to project and to receive their shocks, to suffer or to master their consequences. Nature installs the base of these dynamos in the material bodies she has formed, making these bodies the ground for her stations, and connects the mental with the material by a nerve system full of the movement of vital currents through which the mind becomes conscious of the material world, and so far as it chooses, of the vital world of nature. Otherwise, the mind would be conscious of the mental world first and chiefly, and would only indirectly glimpse the material. As it is, its attention is fixed on the body and the material world in which it has been installed, and it is aware of the rest of existence only dimly, indirectly, or subconsciously, in that vast remainder of itself with regard to which superficially it has become irresponsible, irresponsive, and oblivious.
Are you ready to read, Francis? Have you found
it? I am in place.
So it's your turn.
The soul identifies itself with this mental dynamo or station and says, I am this mind. And since the mind is absorbed in the bodily life, it thinks, I am a mind in a living body. But still more commonly, I am a body which lives and thinks. It identifies itself with the thoughts, emotions, sensation of the embodied mind, and imagines that because when the body is dissolved, all this will dissolve itself as well cease to exist. It becomes conscious of the current persistence of mental personality. It thinks of itself as a mental soul occupying the body, whether once or repeatedly, and returning from earthly living to mental worlds beyond. The persistence of this mental being, mentally enjoying a suffering sometimes in the body, sometimes on the mental, a vital plane of nature, it causes its immortal existence. Or else, because the mind is the principle of light and knowledge, however imperfect, and can have some notion of what is beyond it, it sees the possibility of a dissolution of the mental being into that which is beyond, some void, or some eternal existence, and it says, there, I, the mental soul, cease to be. Such dissolution it dreads or desires, denies or affirms according to the measure of attachment to a repulsion from this present play of embodied mind and vitality. Wow, this is all powerful stuff.
John Robert, you're muted.
Now, all this is a mixture of truth and falsehood. Mind, life, matter exist, and mental, vital, physical individualization exists as facts in nature. But the identification of the soul with these things is a false identification. Mind, life, and matter are ourselves only in this sense, that they are principles of being which the true self has evolved by the meeting and interaction of soul and nature in order to express a form of its one existence as the cosmos. Individual mind, life, and body are a play of these principles, which is set up in the commerce of soul and nature as a means for the expression of that multiplicity of itself, of which the one existence is eternally capable, and which it holds eternally involved in its unity. Individual mind, life, and body are forms of ourselves, insofar as we are centers of the multiplicity of the one. Universal mind, life, and body are also forms of ourself, because we are that one in our being. But the self is more than universal or individual mind, life, and body. And when we limit ourselves by identification with these things, we found our knowledge on a falsehood. We falsify our determining view and our practical experience, not only of our self-being, but of our cosmic existence and of our individual activities.
The self is an eternal utter being and pure existence of which all these things are becomings. From this knowledge we have to proceed. This knowledge we have to realize and make it the foundation of the inner and the outer life of the individual. The yoga of knowledge, starting from these primary truths, has conceived a negative and positive method of discipline by which we shall get rid of these false identifications and recoil back from them into true self-knowledge. The negative method is to say always, I am not the body, so as to contradict and root out the false idea, I am the body, to concentrate on this knowledge and by renunciation of the attachment of the soul to the physical, get rid of the body sense. We say again, I am not the life, and by concentration on this knowledge and renunciation of the attachment to the vital movements and desires, get rid of the life sense. We say finally, I am not the mind, the motion, the sense, the thought. And by concentration on this knowledge and renunciation of the mental activities, get rid of the mind's sense. When we thus constantly create a gulf between ourselves and the things with which we identified ourselves, their veils progressively fall away from us and the self begins to be visible to our experience. Of that, then, we say, I am that, the pure, the eternal, the self-blissful, and by concentrating our thought and being upon it, we become that and are able finally to renounce the individual existence and the cosmos. Another positive method belonging rather to the Raja Yoga is to concentrate on the thought of the Brahman and shut out from us all other ideas, so that this dynamo of mind shall cease to work upon our external or varied internal existence. By mental cessation, the vital and physical play also shall fall to rest in an eternal samadhi, some inexpressible deepest trance of the being in which we shall pass into the absolute existence.
This discipline is evidently a self-centered and exclusive inner movement which gets rid of the world by denying it in thought and shutting the eyes of the soul to it in vision. But the universe is there as a truth in God, even though the individual soul may have shut its eyes to it, and the self is there in the universe, really, and not falsely, supporting all that we have rejected, truly immanent in all things, really embracing the individual in the universal as well as embracing the universe in that which exceeds and transcends it. What shall we do with this eternal self in this persistent universe, which we see encompassing us every time we come out of the trance of inner meditation? The ascetic path of knowledge has its solution and its discipline for the soul that looks out on the universe. It is to regard the immanent and all-encompassing and all-constituting self in the image of the ether in which all forms are, which is in all forms, of which all forms are made. In that ether, cosmic life and mind move as the breath of things, an atmospheric sea in the ethereal, and constitute from it all these forms. But what they constitute are merely name and form and not realities. The form of the pot we see is a form of earth only and goes back into the earth. Earth, a form resolvable into the cosmic life, a movement that falls to rest in that silent, immutable ether. Concentrating on this knowledge, rejecting all phenomenon and appearance, we come to see the whole as an illusion of name and form in the ether that is Brahman. It becomes unreal to us, and the universe becoming unreal, the immanence becomes unreal, and there's only the self upon which our mind has falsely imposed the name and form of the universe. Thus are we justified in the withdrawal of the individual self into the absolute.
Still, the self goes on with its imperishable aspect of immanence, its immutable aspect of divine envelopment, its endless trick of becoming each thing and all things. Our detection of the cheat and our withdrawal do not seem to affect one tittle, either the self or the universe. Must we not then know also what it is that persists, superior to our acceptance and rejection, and too great, too eternal to be affected by it? Here too, there must be some invincible reality at work, and the integrality of knowledge demands that we shall see and realize it. Otherwise, it may prove that our own knowledge and not the Lord in the universe was the cheat and the illusion. Therefore, we must concentrate again and see and realize also this which persists so sovereignly. I must know the self as no other than the Supreme Soul, which is the Lord of nature, the upholder of cosmic existence, by whose sanction it proceeds, whose will compels its multitudinous actions, and determines its perpetual cycles. And we must yet concentrate once again and see and realize and must know the self as the one existence who is both the soul of all and the nature of all, at once Purusha and Prakriti, and so able both to express himself in all these forms of things and to be all these formations. Otherwise, we have excluded what the self does not exclude and made a willful choice in our knowledge.
Is it okay to make comments?
Yes, I was going to go ahead.
All this stuff is so powerful, and like I, at one level, understand it immediately. When I was a little boy, before I went even went to school, I had this, and sometimes I forgot and just become a little boy, but I had this persistent awareness that somehow this reality we live in, bodies, everything, there was something not quite right with it, and that I didn't really belong here. And I had this idea of this reality as kind of an illusion. It was almost like I could just take a pin and just prick it, and it would all kind of evaporate. That was how thin and insubstantial it was, yet it could never quite happen like that. And some of it had to do with a sense of heaven. Maybe I had what I sometimes been called like a divine homesickness. I knew I didn't belong here. I knew I belonged somewhere else, and that this, you know, I couldn't put it rightly into words, couldn't quite pull it all in. But all these things that Sri Aurobindo is talking about, like, beautifully explains what I experienced.
I do find this section, I think it's this idea, the one existence who is both the soul of all and the nature of all at once, Purusha and Prakriti. There's a poetry in this. I think you said it the other day, John Robert, that this is pure poetry. And there is a poetry in this that and so able to express himself in all these forms of things and to be all these formations. I agree with you. It's powerful stuff, Francis, but it's powerful partly because it's poetic. And, you know, it's truth, but it's poetic truth in a sense. And in a way, that's the way I feel about it.
Yeah.
There's a flow to the English. It's easy to get stuck on some of the ideas because they're vast ideas. But if you can just hear the English flowing along, it's like a river. It's like this beautiful river just moving magnificently, majestically along.
Like very much the word choice is very, very powerful. Sometimes I try to find the words to express and don't find it. And when I read Sri Aurobindo, I say, this is a word. For example,
yes.
Mental dynamos, for example, this idea of the mental dynamo individualized. It's an image, a metaphor in a certain sense, but it conveys powerfully the significance, the deep significance of something that goes beyond the physical, it tells me a lot. I can relate a lot with this. Yeah, I would love to have this same linguistic skills. Unfortunately, I don't, but so I'm making a list of the words of Sri Aurobindo, and then I will use it in my writings, perhaps.
Yeah, one way to look at it is Sri Aurobindo had these realizations. He had this inner knowledge on all these deep levels, philosophical, and then at the same time, he had this unbelievable language ability, just mind-blowing language ability. To put it into philosophy, put it into poetry, to put it into instructions. Okay, do this and do this. It's the different yoga instructions. Just mind-blowing, really.
It kind of makes me realize how perfect it was that Sri Aurobindo's father sent him as a young boy to England, where he got completely into the English language and then into Latin and Greek and everything, the entire European culture. And it seemed cruel for me, looking at that at the time, to send your children so far away in a foreign. But what a blessing for us that he got to so deeply penetrate the English language. Yeah.
And then he came back. Just a quick remark on this. The irony of this is that the father wanted to send him to England to protect him from the mystic...
From India.
He wanted him to become a
Western rational person.
Yeah, exactly. It was quite a successful attempt. Yeah. Sorry, Francis, go ahead.
No, that's okay. And then, but to finish it off, then he came back to India and on his own immersed himself in Indian thought and culture and the whole atmosphere. So then he was able to combine the whole English language, Western culture with the Eastern culture. Worked out beautifully.
While we're stopped here, I want to raise a different question. So when earlier on in this chapter, when Sri Aurobindo was talking about how nature presents us with objects and we think about everything separate. Even if we recognize the forces, we think about them as separate forces. And I was wondering about some of these languages that are not noun-based, they're verb-based. So they're not linguistically invested in separation and separate objects and separate things. And I'm wondering how that affects somebody's consciousness in the way that Sri Aurobindo was talking about it here. I don't know if anybody has anything to say about that, but it's something I've been wondering about for a long time and have been collecting commentary, not commentary on Sri Aurobindo's ideas about this, but just commentary on this kind of language, because obviously English is not that. English is a noun-based language. But there are languages that are verb-based languages and that people who speak them can say, you know, we can talk all day without using a noun.
Do you know Vladimir Yatsenko?
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think he's studying for his whole life the subject of linguistics and Sanskrit and spirituality and so on, Sri Aurobindo. If you ask him, I'm sure that he will give you a talk of hours on the subject. So just try out.
Just thought maybe somebody else here had thought about it.
I have thought about it, but I have nothing to say about it. No, I find it very intriguing because it would change your entire perception of reality completely. Everything is always in the process of becoming or being rather than it is, you know. That's, yeah.
There was a professor at CIA. Sorry, Andrea, I thought you were done.
Oh, yeah. So Sri Aurobindo really seems to embody the integral yoga so completely because he has completely absorbed more deeply than most of us, if any of us, Western culture and Indian culture in his one being. And synthesized all of that, you know, it's really amazing.
I was going to say there was a CIIS professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies who did a little video that I have, and he was talking about this. He was a student of Cheyenne, a Native American language. And he said, and I've also seen Barry Lopez, who is a nature writer and very deeply involved in indigenous culture. talk about this. So this video, short video, and he wanted to show that to those, especially to those of us who have no sense of a verb-based language, what it might be like. So he showed a picture of a ball bouncing, you know, just like a little basketball or a soccer ball or something like that bouncing on the floor. And he said, in Western culture, the mom teaching her baby language would say, look at that ball. And the indigenous mom would say, look at the bouncing. So there's a different direction of attention, systematically different direction of attention. And that's out of that little example, you know, I haven't been able to get a really full sense of it. But I keep wondering how that affects this idea of ego, which is basically separation, the sense of being separate. I don't know.
However, to some extent, the recognition of separate things is built into human perception, neurologically speaking. So you can shift perception somewhat with language, but you can't do it completely because our visual system identifies separate things. It's built into the way the neurology works. So I think it's a bit more complex than you're suggesting, John Robert.
I'm not suggesting that it's not complicated. I'm just wondering about it. I'm sure it's vastly complicated, but I'm not sure that the studies that have been done of things like that, which have probably been done by Western scientists who assume the separation as part of the basic axioms of existence, because that's what they learned from their language from the time they were in their mom's womb. I'm not sure that that presents the whole picture, but I don't know. I really don't know.
So then I wonder if there's neurological studies of people who live in those kinds of languages. If it is true that the observation of single objects is innate in the nervous system.
Well, they will say that they can, it's not that they can't make nouns. Mm. There are nouns in their language. It's just that's not their primary experience of the world. It's not primary experience of a bunch of objects. It's, the primary experience is of a flux, of a flow. And they can make distinctions. I mean, there's no question about that. But it's not their kind of their foundation of their experience of the world.
It sounds really wonderful, frankly, to me.
I think it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And I think it's your turn to read, Francis.
Okay. The old ascetic path of knowledge admitted the unity of things and the concentration on all these aspects of the one existence. But it made a distinction and a hierarchy. The self that becomes all these forms of things is the Virat, or universal soul. The self that creates all these forms is, I cannot pronounce that, Hiranyagarbha.
Hiranyagarbha.
Thank you. The luminous or creatively perceived soul, the self that contains all these things. Involved in it, it is prajnana, the conscious cause, originally determining soul. Beyond all these, it's the absolute who permits all this unreality, but has no dealings with it. Into that, we must withdraw and have no further dealings with the universe, since knowledge means the final knowledge, and therefore these lesser realizations must fall away from us to be lost in that. But evidently, from our point of view, these are practical distinctions made by the mind, which have a value for certain purposes, but no ultimate value. Wow. Our view of the world insists on unity. The universal self is not different from the perceptive, creative, nor, the perceptive and creative, nor the perceptive from the causal, nor the causal from the absolute, but it is the one self-being which has become our becomings, and which is not any other than the Lord who manifests himself as these, as all these individual existence, nor the Lord any other than the sole existing Brahman, who verily is all this that we can see, sense, live, and mentalize. That self, Lord Brahman, we would know that we must realize our unity with it and all that it manifests. And in that unity, we would live. For we demand of knowledge that it shall unite. The knowledge that divides must always be a partial knowledge, good for certain practical purposes. The knowledge that unites is the knowledge.
Therefore, our integral yoga will take up these various disciplines and concentrations, but harmonize and, if possible, fuse them by a synthesis which removes their mutual exclusions. Not realizing the Lord and the All, only to reject them for silent self or unknowable absolute, as would an exclusively transcendental, nor living for the Lord alone or in the All alone, as would an exclusively theistic or exclusively pantheistic yoga, the seeker of integral knowledge will limit himself neither in his thought, nor in his practice, nor in his realization by any religious creed or philosophical dogma. He will seek the truth of existence in its completeness. The ancient disciplines he will not reject, for they rest upon eternal truths, but he will give them an orientation in conformity with his aim.
We must recognize that our primary aim in knowledge must be to realize out our own supreme self more than that self in others, or as the Lord of nature, or as the All. For that is the pressing need of the individual, to arrive at the highest truths of his own being, to set right its disorders, confusions, false identifications, to arrive at its right concentration and purity, and to know and mount to its source. But we do this not in order to disappear into its source, but so that our whole existence and all the members of this inner kingdom may find their right basis, may live in our highest self, live for our highest self only, and obey no other law than that which proceeds from our highest self and is given to our purified being without any falsification in the transmitting mentality. And if we do this rightly, we shall discover that in finding this supreme self, we have found the one self in all, the one Lord of our nature and of all nature, the All of ourselves, who is the All of the universe. For this that we see in ourselves, we must necessarily see everywhere, since that is the truth of his unity. By discovering and using rightly the truth of our being, the barrier between our individuality and the universe will necessarily be forced up open and cast away, and the truth that we realize in our own being cannot fail to realize itself to us in the universality, which will then be ourself. Realizing in ourself the I am He of the Vedanta, We cannot but realize in looking upon all around us the identical knowledge on its other side. Thou art that. We have only to see how practically the discipline must be conducted in order that we may arrive successfully at this great unification. Yeah, great chapter. The second reading was much more powerful for me than the first passage. The first thing, I don't know. I didn't see lots of things that I saw now. Interesting, huh? And if there would be the third reading, this would be the same. And the fourth reading and fifth reading. Never end the reading. Yeah.
Shall we read on through the next section? Or it's a shorter chapter slightly. Instead of 8 pages, 6 pages.
Should we read through it all? Okay.
We could read through it.
I was wondering, Jeffrey, I remember the last time you talked about a passage where it talked about the soul, I might not say it exactly right, possessing the body, something to that, the possession part of it.
Yeah.
And you were questioning something about it. I was looking for that to come up, but I must have missed it.
It was there, because I made a note of it when we went through the first time.
And I wondered if you had any more comments.
No, I was happy with the sort of suggestion that Don Salmon gave. It was on page 337 at the top of the page. I am the stream of life. I have entered into the possession of this body. This that argument.
It is the third paragraph. He said the error at least he has one possession. I don't know if it's that what you mean, Jeffrey Jen.
What Don Salmon said is you need to think about possession as a kind of loving union, which I quite liked as a way of understanding it. So.
But here in the third paragraph, he says, the error proceeds from a false identification. Nature has created within her material unity separate seeming bodies, which the soul manifested in material nature enfolds, inhabits, possesses, uses. The soul forgetting itself experiences only the single knot in matter and says, I am this body. So it's the soul manifested in material nature possesses.
So the word that comes to me is immanent, which he uses in this book too, in this chapter.
Yeah, well, immanent I have no problem with. You know, it's that's the possession. So
immanent, yeah. in creation, and that brings it all together. Mm. Yeah.
And sometimes Sri Aurobindo uses words in ways that we don't normally use them. He uses a word that, like, wow, I never thought of using that word to describe that.
There's that line, the self goes on with its imperishable aspect of immanence. That's a beautiful description of what I think of as reincarnation.
Now that whole sentence, Andrea, is wonderful. That one, yeah, that you started there.
Yeah. Shall we read it again?
Sure.
Shall I read it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Still, the self goes on with its imperishable aspect of immanence, its immutable aspect of divine envelopment, its endless trick of becoming each thing and all things. Our detection of the cheat and our withdrawal do not seem to affect one tittle, either of the self or the universe. Can somebody explain that, our detection of the cheat? What is referred to as a cheat?
I assumed it was the ego. Understanding of the world as separate things and so forth.
Okay.
That's what I take it to.
Okay, you got you.
And again, interesting that he uses that word cheat, because that's a very common English word, and he applies it here. What's going on? It's a cheat to create this illusion.
Yes, it cheats our consciousness. Must we not then know also what it is that thus persists, superior to our acceptance and rejection, and too great, too eternal to be affected by it? Here, too, there must be some invincible reality at work, and the integrality of knowledge demands that we shall see and realize it. Otherwise, it may prove that our own knowledge, and not the Lord in the universe, was the cheat and the illusion. Therefore, we must concentrate again and see and realize also this which persists so sovereignly, and must know the self as no other than the Supreme Soul, which is the Lord of nature, the upholder of cosmic existence, by whose sanction it proceeds, whose will compels its multitudinous actions and determines its perpetual cycles. Wow. And we must yet concentrate once again and see and realize and must know the self as the one existence who is both the soul of all and the nature of all, at once Purusha and Prakriti, and so able both to express himself in all these forms of things and to be all these formations. Otherwise, we have excluded what the self does not exclude and made a willful choice in our knowledge.
I also like this first part of the last paragraph on page 342, where he talks about our primary aim and knowledge as an individual.
Yeah.
He says to realize our own supreme self more than that self in others.
Yeah, this is really quite striking. I really noticed that too, how central that is here. That without it, we can't realize the self in others, right? Because we are excluding ourselves. Yeah.
I think Mother said somewhere that our primary responsibility is to our own life.
Yeah.
So this means that if we want to help others, we have first of all help ourselves. That's a perhaps more modern way of putting it. People are slowly but steadily realizing it. We cannot save the world if we don't save first of all ourselves. And that there. That our spiritual evolution, progression, determines the spiritual evolution also of others. And we cannot save others if we have not saved ourselves. Not in the absolute sense, I think, but because, what means saving? No, I don't go into this, because in a Christian environment, I think save this has another connotation. But you see this also in politics. this idea of creating new worlds and making things, new technologies, saving the world. But there's no little discussion about making us better as human beings. And that's a big difficulty of our society, that we...
Well, that is not obvious in the news, but it's happening everywhere. There's a lot of movement in that realm. But that's not newsworthy because it's not dramatic.
Exactly.
Somewhere, I forget where it was, but I might not get it perfectly, but it was Sri Aurobindo, and he was talking about kind of three levels that have to do with growth, moving forward. And there was that inner being working, what he's talking about here, that our own realization. And then he said, in the way of the world, there is self-development, so we can work on our egos, so to speak, get better and more self-esteem, become more skilled, etc. And then there's a third way of working, trying to, trying to change the world. But he keeps referring us back to that first way of our own inner being, not our psychological being or personality, but our inner being. And that's the foundation where we have to keep going back to.
So that I'm glad you mentioned ego, because I was really struck when Sri Aurobindo mentions ego here on the top of the second page. So because we know neither the universe nor ourselves for what they really are, but with an imperfect view founded on a temporary fiction which the soul and nature have established between themselves for the convenience of the evolving ego. And I would be very interested to see more about that from Sri Aurobindo. It's probably somewhere, because he writes about everything. But the evolving ego is really? Clearly, the ego has an essential part in our evolution. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there.
But I like the wording temporary fiction. It's just a fiction, so everything that you perceive. So he does not deny what the illusionists say, the Vedanta, and they say everything is Maya. Yeah, because you are seeing things from the mental point of view. And then it's a fiction, yes, it's true. And yet he says no. So you see, it's nice to see how he brings together apparent contradictions which seem to exclude each other, and yet nope, you must make the synthesis, and you see the things from a comprehensive way.
Yeah, he always goes further. He always goes further. It's like it's never quite enough, and no, then there's more. Like Savitri, the whole of, his whole Ashapati's journey in the Savitri is that, Yeah, this is wonderful, but there's more.
Yeah, and that's what science is discovering now, that there is more. Now, many scientists are speculating on the fact that so-called idealism, philosophical idealism, is coming back. It's an old tradition, but it's coming back because they are now realizing, it seems to be a fiction. It is, in a certain sense.
So I feel quite complete with our time today. I don't know how others feel. Then we can, the next chapter, maybe we can read it twice the next time.
Yeah, I agree. It's too short, too late now to read the next chapter. So.
Okay, should we make 2 minutes meditation? Thank you, everybody.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Lovely.
Bye-bye.
See you next time.